This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Hot Topic episode number 8 was recorded on the 12th of March, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. Joining me today is Tracy Schuchart, better known as Shy Girl, her call sign on Twitter. Tracy, it's been a long time since we did our last Energy Week podcast. We've had quite a few requests to get you on the show, so it's great to have you back with us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back as usual, Eric.
So, listeners, we've got two major topics to talk to you about today with respect to the oil market. The first one is coronavirus. What does it mean? What's coming? Where are we headed with all of this? And how is it going to affect energy markets? Compounding that is the second major topic, which is Saudi Arabia and Russia have had something of a falling out, and for now at least is manifesting itself as a price war. There's a lot of speculation. Some people think we're in for a price war that's going to last for months and months or years and years. Other people are saying it's all a big bluff and it's going to blow over very quickly. We'll get into that and talk about our perspectives on both of those things. Tracy, our listeners, hopefully, what will be yesterday, by the time they hear this podcast, will air on Friday the 13th. Great timing, huh? Friday the 13th. On Thursday the 12th, we released a podcast all about the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis and my economic analysis of what that means. So listeners, I encourage you to listen to that one. Tracy has not heard it yet because we're taping this podcast on Thursday before that one even came out. So Tracy, I'm going to give you the quick overview of what listeners will have heard if they listen to that podcast, because I'd really like to get your perspective, and by all means, feel free to disagree if you do. Basically, this is my most bearish podcast yet, and it's a reflection of a lot of things I've suspected for a month now, but I really didn't feel comfortable saying publicly until I felt pretty confident they were going to happen. And it's not pretty. I think that Italy and what Italy is going through right now, which is a complete breakdown of their healthcare system. So this crisis is not about everybody dying. It's about a whole lot of people needing hospital care because the COVID-19 coronavirus, although the death rate is reasonably low, it's still scary, but it's reasonably low. The serious complication rate, which is the number of people that require hospitalization, is very high. It's 15 to 20%. If millions and millions of people get this thing, it means you need hundreds of thousands of hospital beds that we don't have. So I expect that I think Italy is a proxy for what's about to happen if you follow the exponential growth curves. So while in most European countries right now, you're still looking at high hundreds to low thousands of cases, that's where Italy was a week ago. Now, as of today, Italy is at over 15,000 cases with 2,650 cases added today alone. More than 1,000 deaths in Italy and 200 deaths just reported today. So what you're seeing in Italy is what you're going to see for the rest of Europe in about 1 week's time and what you're going to see in the United States in about 10 days' time. So we're down to a couple of weeks before the shit really hits the fan in the United States and in Europe. Now, just today, we're getting the market finally starting to wake up to this. Really big moves down in the S&P, big moves in bond yields and so forth. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. I don't think the market has come to terms with what's coming yet. So this is a really big deal. Before we even get into what the implications are for energy markets, I wanted to start with that summary, Tracy, because that's a quick overview of what was in yesterday's podcast. I want to get your reactions. How do you see things before we get to the energy implications just of what's coming with respect to COVID-19?
I mean, in general, I think because, you know, I mean, my area, really, I've been focusing on supply chains and shipping. And that's really what I've been keeping track of. And because of the lag time between shipping between the U.S. and China, now we're just really starting to see those supply chain breakdowns because it takes 6 to 8 weeks. Whereas, you know, with Europe, that time is a lot more condensed. So they came out with, there was an ISM supplement survey published, and there was 75% of companies are already seeing capacity disruptions in their supply chains. So this is going to start to be a big deal. We've already seen 16 to 17% of business slashed at ports in Long Beach and Los Angeles, which are huge ports, which is affecting the trucking industry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're really just now starting to feel the economic impacts of this virus.
And I think the main point that I wanted to make is the worst is yet to come, and I don't think people have really come to terms with what's about to happen. The situation in Italy is dire, and they've actually had to lock down the entire country. I think we need to think about the range of possibility, and of course, we can't have a crystal ball, but as much as it feels like it's unthinkable that the U.S. could go into a lockdown across the country the way China did, look, China would never, ever have done that to their own economy unless they had to, unless there was no other way. We did have the opportunity to prepare and take measures against this. We haven't done that. The U.S. has done a terrible job with respect to aggressive testing and contact tracing and the various things that are needed to shift the infection curve to the right, as epidemiologists like to encourage us to do in these situations. So I think that the U.S. is very poorly prepared. The rest of Europe is, I don't think, going to be any better than Italy. And what I foresee is much more widespread shutdowns. Right now, they're talking about banning public gatherings and events of more than 500 people. Pretty soon, it's going to be don't have any interactions with other human beings unless you have to. Believe it or not, there's actually suddenly a hashtag trending on Twitter, which is hashtag stay the fuck home, which is rather candid language, but I think it really encapsulates the point, which is the way to combat this thing is to not get it. And the way that to not get it is to not be exposed to it. And that is to avoid contact with other people. That really means a whole lot of things getting canceled, a whole lot of people shunning air travel. Right now, we're in this crazy euphoria stage where I've read a couple of articles saying that college students are just euphoric, saying there's fantastic deals on flights. We're going to take a trip around the world and take advantage of this thing. The hell with it. I think that when we get to the healthcare system being overwhelmed the way it is in Italy, not enough hospital beds to go around, people being turned away from the emergency room and told, we're sorry, we just can't help you. I think that attitude will change, and there's effectively a sudden stop in the economy, which is completely unlike anything that's ever occurred in modern times. How do you even begin, Tracy? See, I'll throw this into your lap. Tell us, Tracy, how do you translate that to an outlook for oil demand? I mean, wow, it's a problem, but how do you even begin to quantify it?
Well, therein lies the problem, Eric. I mean, we don't know. You know, we're already seeing, now that we're an exporting nation, we're already seeing the demand problems elsewhere, but this is going to be an internal problem. And I don't think there is a way to quantify that because we don't know. I mean, already, as you said, we're already seeing unprecedented things like NCAA is canceled, NHL is canceled, baseball, spring training was just canceled, every conference was just canceled, flights, domestic flights are being canceled. You know, slowdown in ports means that you don't have truckers moving to the ports, you don't have ships moving, so that's marine fuel demand. I mean, there's just no way to really quantify what that is going to do just domestically as far as demand is concerned.
Now, one of the things that I think you are a lot more knowledgeable about than I am, I know the basics that it's not just a matter of saying, hey, you know, we can forecast this thing's coming. Just call the oil producers and tell them to turn the switch off for a couple of weeks and stop producing oil. It doesn't work that way. Shutting in an oil well is a big, expensive, involved process. So nobody's going to shut in production. What happens? How long does it take before, if there's a huge slowdown in demand, how long does it take before we run out of storage? And then, of course, the next step is floating storage. And at some point, you run out of enough ships for floating storage. how much production, if we really had a sudden shock where demand just, you know, dropped by 50% or more overnight, but you couldn't really slow down production. Do you have any idea, Tracy, of how long it would take before you completely run out of storage capacity to store that oil?
I mean, I would think that it would take, you know, somewhere between 9 to 12 months before you really started to see a dent, because, you know, we still have the SPR that we have, and that we've actually sold a lot out of that recently. So that can be filled. We still have Cushing, which luckily is kind of coming from a low level, 39 million barrels. So we have room there. But, you know, and it's also hard to quantify because you don't know really what demand's going to be like. But I would say, you know, really 9 to 12 months before we would really have to start getting worried. But I would really, your gauge of it is going to be looking at those Cushing inventories, just for the listeners out there. That's really what you want to be looking at. Not forget crude stocks. Start looking at Cushing inventories, because if those really start rising, then you know we have a serious problem.
You're saying forget crude stocks, which is the measure of all the storage, and focus specifically on Cushing, Oklahoma. Please elaborate.
Well, it's the WTI contract, for one thing. It is a smaller storage, and it's what they will fill immediately, right? They're not going to put it in SPR immediately. They're going to put it in Cushing immediately. So that's where I would be looking if you really want to see what the demand shock is. And also watch exports and things like that. I mean, if exports really go down, then do we have a problem at ports? Do we have a worldwide problem? I mean, there's a lot of ways to sort of look at those reports. But I would say in general, my eye will be on Cushing more so than actual stocks.
Let's suppose the government says, okay, fill her up, oil industry, whatever you can fit in the SPR, Congress is ready to pay for that oil. How much is that? How much spare capacity exists in the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve?
So the reserve actually holds about 713.5 million barrels. Currently, we're at 634.9, so we have about 78.6 million barrels still left in the SPR.
Okay, so 78 million in the SPR, and I think Cushing, all of Cushing, the whole tank, not just available, is like 90 or 100,000, isn't it? So we've got, between Cushing and the SPR, we've probably got 150,000 barrels of capacity to store more oil before we start to run into a problem. And of course, then you've got the other non-Cushing storage facilities, and then you've got floating storage comes after that. So presumably, we're headed toward a super contango situation in the market, where there's a discount for immediate delivery of oil. And if you want to buy later out on the curve, you have to pay a premium because of the demand for storage. What else do we expect? I mean, it's so hard to even begin to put prices on this, but it seems to me that as storage becomes critical, and the only way to deal with that storage problem is a lot of expensive floating storage, potentially front month prices, just the front month, really get pulled down pretty darn low. Any idea of what we might expect?
I mean, again, you know, it's really hard to quantify because we don't know how long this is going to last, you know, and I don't think we'll get into a situation necessarily where we fill the entire Cushing and the entire SPR. At least I'm hoping not. But, you know, still, you know, we're just getting into this scenario where, you know, it really hasn't hit three continents yet. So not only domestic demand, or I should say North American demand, but, you know, we've also got South America and Africa. So we could see front month prices really pulled down a lot, just not globally, not only, you know, domestically, but globally.
We haven't even gotten to the Saudi Arabia-Russia situation yet, but in reaction to that, Goldman issued a note, and as far as I can tell, Goldman's note was really just a reaction to Saudi and Russia. They were saying you could easily see prices come down, stabilizing maybe around 30, but dipping to $20 per barrel. just on the Russia and Saudi Arabia news we haven't talked about yet, I don't think that they were fully factoring in everything that's coming with COVID-19. So if you compound them both, if Russia and Saudi Arabia don't make up and agree on some kind of production cut, I think that you're looking at teens, low teens potentially, before it's over. And I certainly don't think that that's going to last very long. It would only be on the front month, and it would be with a super contango. So you'd need to have a tank in order to buy at that low of a price. But I think that, you know, maybe even if this really were to be as severe as I fear it is, a test of $10 seems entirely plausible on the front month only. What do you think?
I mean, I think that I won't go as far as to say 10, but I will say that, you know, definitely I could see upper teens.
Okay. Well, that certainly is a number that was unthinkable. I mean, that was laugh you out of the room unthinkable 2 weeks ago. And we both agree that that's very possible now. Tracy, let's move on to the second major topic that plays into all this. We had all this coronavirus stuff coming. It hadn't really hit the tape yet. Now it's finally starting to. And again, folks, I've been watching this coronavirus situation very closely for well over a month, and I've had a pretty good track record of knowing what's coming. I don't think it's fully priced in yet. I don't think traders have really come to terms with what's about to happen to the global economy. So already you've got a very, very bearish outlook for energy markets. But then on top of everything else, Tracy, let me do this way. I'm going to present my understanding of what happened at OPEC Plus, because you're much closer to this. You can correct me if I have it wrong. But basically, the OPEC Plus meeting, which is the OPEC producers plus Russia, had a meeting to talk about a production cut. Saudi Arabia was pushing for a 1.5 million barrel additional cut beyond the cuts they've already agreed to in the second quarter. Russia basically said no and left. And first, what OPEC Plus did is they spun this very, frankly, misleading press release that said OPEC Plus, the committee, has agreed to a 1.5 million barrel cut in Q2, and then in the fine print, subject to Russia's agreement to join in and participate. Markets spiked up like crazy on that news. Then they read the fine print and realized that Russia had not agreed to this and came right back down. Then the really big move that we saw down, the first big move that we saw down last week, last Friday, was when Russia reiterated, no means no, we weren't just bluffing, don't ask us again, we're not going to change our mind. Then on Saturday, as I understand it, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, basically kind of lost his temper and said, okay, if you want to play ball that way, here's what we're going to do. We are going to just dramatically cut our prices and increase to maximum production. We're going to turn the screws all the way up, and we're going to produce, 12 or 13 million barrels a day. We're going to give the U.S. a run for its money in terms of being the biggest producer, and we're going to go balls to the wall with oil production, and the hell with it. If that crashes the price, I hope it teaches Russia a lesson. That's kind of the way I understand the events. And of course, then on the Sunday evening futures crash, Tracy, you and I and all the other oil traders on Twitter were just taking bets on how big that gap down open was going to be and how many halts would occur on the market before eventually we tested $27.34, I believe was the low, just a few hours after the open on Sunday night. So that's the history. Now, a whole bunch of people have been saying, and there's rumors just in the last few days saying, okay, look, it's all a bluffing game. This is only going to last a few days. Russia and Saudi Arabia, they're going to kiss and make up. They're going to agree on a production deal. I don't get it, Tracy. I know that's what the rumor has been, but I don't get it. I don't understand why anybody thinks that. Russians culturally are generally not the type to back down. I think that both sides lose face if they walk away from the positions they've taken. Feels to me like this rift between them is going to last a while. Am I missing something, or how do you see this?
Well, actually, today there was news today that kind of switched all that. I mean, the idea that Russia was going to go to the joint technical meeting, gave people hope, which was scheduled for March 18th. Then they turned it into a teleconference. And then basically, there's word out today, and I feel like this keeps changing on a daily basis. There was word out today that nobody was going, the meeting was entirely canceled, but the market didn't actually react at all on that sort of news. So I'm not, you know, I think that if they do meet, there is a chance, but obviously if that meeting's canceled and not happening, then forget it, then it's not happening.
Yeah, and I guess it's certainly, I could see why Russia would want to be involved and send a representative, but the way their messaging was, they said, if there's a meeting, we'll send a representative. I didn't see any signaling that suggests, you know, we're ready to cave in. And I mean, what are they going to say? Okay, Mohammed bin Salman, you put us in our place. We're going to submit to you. I mean, I don't see that happening.
No, but I mean, what I think, I mean, Russia didn't actually just 100% walked away from the deal. What Russia presented is, let's just keep the plan the way that it is and give this a little bit more time so we can really see what the demand effects are from the coronavirus. So they didn't just say, no, we want out of this deal and we walked away from the table. The thing is that the Saudis said, okay, it's going to be 1.5 million or nothing. And Russia said, well, we want some time. So there was just no agreement there. So basically, the agreement broke off. They said, take it or leave it. Russia said, we don't want it. And so that's how the meeting actually ended. So it wasn't as if Russia just said, we're ending this deal and that's it. And, you know, and there's some outside factors, too. I mean, you have to realize when Russia got into this as well, they didn't expect this to be a 4-year-long deal. You know, when this happened in 2016, they thought this was going to be a couple deals. They didn't realize this was going to go on forever. And, you know, it's kind of been a thorn in their side, right? As well as, you know, Russia's been having some problems with, you know, Saudi Arabia in Yemen and Syria. That's kind of been a thorn in their side. So, you know, I think Russia just was like, this is our deal. Saudi Arabia said, this is our deal. And they both walked away at that time.
Now, I have a theory about this, and I haven't heard anyone else echo this. Maybe I'm crazy, but I wonder if Mohammed bin Salman actually was looking at this situation thinking, boy, he maybe saw the coronavirus situation coming, because it has been pretty clear to anyone who's looking carefully for the evidence of what's coming. He knew that oil prices had to crash as a result of the coronavirus. And it's like, okay, do I want to be seen as the guy who lost control of the market and it was on my watch that prices crashed? Or do I want to be seen as the bold leader who is not afraid to take decisive action and make it look like it's my fault that oil prices crashed in order to avoid letting it happen in a way that looks like I'm losing control of the market? I can create the appearance of being in control of the market by saying I'm the one who decided to crash oil prices in order to teach Russia a lesson. So I almost wonder if part of the reason that Mohammed bin Salman did this is because he knew there was nothing that could be done to stop prices from crashing no matter what. What do you think? Am I crazy to think that?
No, I mean, you know, it's kind of that, you know, reverse psychology thing. And actually, if I think about it, that actually does kind of make sense, being that Trump has been in conversations and in contact with MBS. And basically today he said he got off the phone with him and he says he likes low pump prices. So, you know, perhaps he was called and told, this is what I'm going to do, or something like that. So I can kind of see that angle.
Where do you think this is headed? I mean, certainly Harold Hamm has been very clear in intimating that he is asking for some kind of federal government bailout for the shale industry. On the one hand, I think it's needed. It's very clear that the U.S. shale industry, I personally don't think that Russia and Saudi Arabia, you know, some people are saying Russia and Saudi Arabia are just putting on a show. They actually collaborated and agreed to do this for the sake of damaging U.S. shale. I think that's paranoid conspiracy thinking. I don't think that's it.
I think if you actually believe that, and then you would have to believe, if you have to believe this is a war on shale, then you're going to have to believe that it comes with Trump's blessing, because he just said he likes low pump prices and he just got off the phone with MBS. So if that's your thinking, then you have to believe that it comes with a blessing from the president of the United States, which I don't think that is.
Well, and I definitely don't think that that was the motivation, but it's very clear that shale, U.S. shale, is collateral damage in this price war. And it, well, it was collateral damage just from the coronavirus crisis before we even got to a Russia-Saudi Arabia price war. And on the one hand, I can see that it is a very, very good idea for the United States to protect its energy interest, to bail out its oil industry so that you don't have both massive bankruptcies leading to loss of American jobs, but also for the sake of energy security. You know, you don't want to go back to the U.S. losing its ability to independently produce energy and have to be dependent on imports. So there's a lot of really good, sensible reasons to make that happen. But frankly, in an election year, you know the way President Trump's opponents are going to spin this is he wants to bail out his billionaire friends in the oil industry at the expense of Main Street America. And it would be met, I think, with a huge amount of public opposition. What do you think is on the horizon in terms of how this might play out and how it might go down?
I agree with you, Eric. I mean, I think it would be very bad optics in an election year to, you know, have these massive bailouts for the shale industry.
Okay, then what's going to happen for the shale industry if there's not a bailout? It seems to me like, I mean, in terms of any new drilling, it's got to be off the table for now. Can the shale industry survive on its existing wells, and how long can it survive? We don't know how long this crisis will go on. We figure that, you know, China's starting to get to the recovery stage now, so looks to me like maybe we've got another 4 to 6 months before we're on the upswing on the other side of this. Of course, you never know when season two starts, but how long can the U.S. shale industry survive without a bailout, given everything that's going on?
So realistically speaking, we have about 6 months at these prices because they're really not going to start drilling a lot of new wells. So what we drilled in the last 6 months will carry us forward 6 months, and then that's when we start really getting into trouble.
Now, Tracy, the way this used to work in the good old days is these shale guys would hedge their forward production, and that was normally negotiated through a cashless collar transaction with an investment bank that would then lay that risk off in the futures market. And the idea was that they were pretty much protected. There was a range of prices they might get, but if it got down to the bottom of that range, they would still be able to sell their production at those prices. And that's the whole function of hedging in the futures market. A few years ago, some genius came up with the idea that, well, you know, the price can't go down that low, so they could reduce the cost of that transaction with something called a three-way collar, where you've got a range of protection, but if the price really goes low, you don't really have all that protection after all, or at least that's the way I understand it. How much do you know about these three-way collars, and do they come into play as we get to lower prices?
They're already in play. So if we take, for example, Oxy, and you can look these up. Anybody can look these up for any companies. I just happen to have Oxy's on hand. So what they did is they sold a $76 call. They purchased the $55 put, and then they sold. They put a floor on it at $45.
Because it can't go below that. Nobody would ever want to protect against that risk because it could never happen.
So that's kind of where they are. That's one, you know, and then you've got MRO, Marathon Oil. Their floor is $47. So a lot of these guys, even in their hedges, are upside down right now.
Okay, so we've really got a cash flow problem, a bigger one than I understood, in the shale patch. No wonder Harold Hamm is panicking. And even if President Trump wants to bail him out, I think you and I agree that politically it would be very difficult for him to do that right now. So what would that mean? I mean, I think there's a very strong argument that the U.S. should not risk losing its domestic oil industry. We can't just let the whole industry go bankrupt. That's really, really not good for energy security. It's not good for national security. And of course, it's not good for the economy. So what do we do, or what happens next?
I mean, I think that, you know, say the worst case scenario happens, we are going to see production declines. We are going to see bankruptcies and mergers and acquisitions. I don't think it's going to get to, you know, a dire point as far as production numbers, how much we can produce. I think that could be reduced. You know, I think you could start seeing it taper off the latter half of this year, given that our 6 month lag time, and then maybe into 2021, maybe see 800 to a million barrel decline in the worst case scenario. That's kind of what I'm looking at. But ultimately, you know, what's going to happen is this industry is going to consolidate more and be more cost effective. So it's not the end of the world for shale. It's just that this time we're going to have a problem because, you know, when we had the crash in 2014, in 2016, you know, we had a bunch of private equity guys that, you know, threw $30 billion first half of, you know, 2016 it was. Got everybody excited in this industry again. You know, we started to see oil prices come up. If we have another crash, well, we're kind of already having a crash scenario, but if we have another, you know, crash scenario that way, the problem is the first round was the banks, the second round was the private equity guys, and there just isn't going to be that kind of cash available. So these guys are really going to have to get their act together.
Unfortunately, I agree with you, Tracy. Everything that I've been reading says the environment that was created by the first several rounds of quantitative easing, where there was just so much money in the junk bond market, you know, the guys on Wall Street were just hunting for a place to put their capital to work because they had so much capital that they needed to find a place for. It was money desperately searching for something to invest in. You don't have that economic backdrop anymore. And furthermore, you've got, I think, Wall Street kind of has a bad taste in its mouth because as much as shale has been an incredible success story for the United States in terms of restoring its status as an oil producer, from a dollars and cents standpoint, nobody made very much money on those shale companies, at least not so far. And I don't think that there's much appetite on Wall Street. You know, if we said we need another really big tranche of a few hundred billion dollars to bail out the shale industry, so why doesn't Wall Street step up, get a few PE funds together to raise some money and do a junk bond offering? It ain't going to happen as far as I can tell. What do you think is going to mean? What will that mean? Do these companies continue to operate their existing producing assets and just wait till those decline out of production and then go bankrupt? I'm trying to figure out what is the ray of hope. We have a lot of our listeners work in the oil patch, and this is obviously a very dire situation. I'd love to end the podcast on a positive note, so I'll just say, Tracy, give us the good news. There's got to be some.
The good news in the end is that shale will survive, right? And I think it will be stronger after this because, you know, the distressed companies that should have never been capitalized with debt in the first place back in 2016, you know, we won't have this sort of problem again, because it, you know, the restructuring of the industry will just not be the same way because, as you said, you know, QE, you're not going to have OPEC come around this time and, you know, cut production and save the market. So in the end, I think it will all be okay. There's just, in the meantime, going to be a lot of pain.
I wonder if there's any angle here for, you know, I'm thinking about Donald Trump and his messaging of put America first. What do you think the Democratic reaction would be if President Trump said, look, what we need to do, we overpaid for mortgage-backed securities a few years ago in order to bail out our financial industry. We need to take care of Americans. We're going to pay market rates for imported oil, but we're going to fill that SPR up with oil from American producers, and we're going to pay $60 a barrel for it in order to bail the industry out. And we're going to get the oil. It's a good price for the oil in the long run. We're just going to not take advantage. We'll take advantage of this deep discount situation that's been created by Russia and Saudi Arabia when we're buying oil from them. But when we're buying from Americans, we're going to pay full price. Do you think that's any easier to sell to Democrats in Congress than an outright bailout of the industry?
Absolutely, I do. Absolutely do. And I also think that it's a smart thing to do because, you know, once again, what's happened, it's proved that, you know, you can't count on OPEC. Really, this kind of thing is like, okay, well, OPEC failed, said they were going to flood the market. You can't count on OPEC. And it's kind of why the SPR was started back in 75, right? We wanted our own oil. We didn't want to have to be, you know, dependent on that kind of control over the oil market. So I think it's smart to go ahead and fill that. I don't think, you know, we've been getting rid of it. I think we should keep it.
Well, there's another way to implement sort of the same thing, which is if you put a hefty tax on import of foreign oil so that you're giving your North American, and you could either do it as import from anywhere outside of the United States, or some people have suggested a North American oil pact where Canada and the United States and Mexico join together and say, we're going to use North American oil. That's going to be our favored choice. And if our refineries need to import oil, that's fine, but they pay a really big import duty on buying, not buying American, or not buying North American, I should say. That probably would be easier to sell politically than overpaying.
I don't think so. I'm going to have to disagree there. I think that would be very hard to swallow, being that, you know, Saudi Arabia wholly owns Motiva, which is the largest refinery in the United States. And basically, it would be a real political mishap with them if you were to say that, because basically you're saying you own this refinery and we're going to charge you for buying your own oil, right? I just don't think that would fly politically, geopolitically between the two countries. I think that Saudi Arabia would not like that one bit. So I think you would run into problems in that scenario, in my opinion.
Well, Tracy, we're just about out of time. Before I let you go today, please tell our listeners where they can follow you on Twitter. You've also got a website. Let us know what you're up to and where people can find out more about what you do.
Obviously, I'm on Twitter at ShyGirl. My website is chigrl.com. I do not keep up with it, but there's some good information on there if you ever want to take a look. But really, you know, you can find me on Twitter.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we really appreciate you joining us today for the Macro Voices Podcast Network. I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.